Hey, Jews, you know that episode of Friends where Ross and Monica have their own in-the-family sibling gesture that is their version of the middle finger? Well, Liel and Stephanie and I have one of those, too. We use it all the time, and you can't see it. However, we also sometimes use words, swear words. So if you have a child around, maybe send him or her out of the room and then come listen to us. Okay, thanks, and here's your gesture. On with the show. Hello, Flatiron District. It was great to swim in the ocean, but we are back in New York City. This is Unorthodox, the weekly podcast from Tablet Magazine. I'm Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Tablet senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
What is this Ira Glass?
I switched it up again. I switched it up. I went Liel first. And also by
Adele, I give my joint today to Stephanie.
To Stephanie, hello.
No, you break it in half and
I
give
do.
Me half.
Also, half of my shalom is to you.
By Tablet Deputy Editor Stefania Butnick.
Hi.
Two Jews this week. Two Jews for the price of one. Two Jews, no Gentile.
We're like done with Gentiles.
Scott Feinberg.
Too nice.
Scott Feinberg, the awards columnist for The Hollywood Reporter and a fine podcaster in his own right, will be here to talk Oscars. And also cookbook writer Molly Yay, author of the cookbook Molly on the Range. No Gentiles this week. They're all too busy golfing and sipping gin and tonics. Is that played out? Is that stereotype just...
I think it's very specific. I mean, that to me is a WASP, but is...
Right.
I guess WASP is just standing for Gentile at this point.
But not... We should be more precise.
I think most of America drinks gin.
One of my friends told me that WASPs don't wear their pajamas to breakfast when they're home with their families. Do you think that's true?
So, interesting. Sid, Jewish wife of mine, did not used to like... I mean, I don't know what she wore to breakfast before she met me, but once she got dressed, she didn't undress until bedtime. Like the idea that at 5, like when I get home at 5 o'clock, I'm in pajamas.
Yeah, I'm in soft pants.
Yeah, like it goes to comfy clothes. And she would not, that was an innovation for her that you could do comfy clothes from like 5 to 11 p.m.
So you're saying she's a WASP? She's one of those Lower East Side WASPs.
She is
I've
one
heard
of those
them.
Lower East Side WASPs. She's a
I just split
WASP.
The difference and just not wear pants, which is really easy.
But you wear like a tuxedo on top.
I do. Like it's a jacket, but underwear.
Is there a cummerbund? And if so, what does it do?
If that's how you'd like to imagine it. Cummerbund holds all kinds of things together. I can't wait for your wedding, man. Do you own a tuxedo?
I owned one tuxedo in my life. It was the one I bought for my prom because I thought it was undignified to wear a rented tuxedo.
That's amazing. And that's everything we need to know about
yeah,
you.
That's right.
And it was the cummerbund and bow tie were red plaid.
I like that.
I think I gave it to one of those clothing drives for people who needed interview clothes.
Oh, God.
I pity the homeless person.
And that's why we have no middle class.
Yeah, sir, we would really like to give you the job, but why wear?
So good to be back in the city.
I have to say, I had the most fun in Florida.
It was amazing.
We like all hung out for really like the first time ever.
Yeah. We hung at Kennebunk.
Yes.
And we felt Orthodoxans, J. Crew, the J. Crew.
That I love that. Someone emailed that.
Someone
to us.
Emailed us referring to us as the J. Crew. But we felt that you were all there with us as we hot tubbed at Kennebunk. And I really bonded with Ben Cohen, the future Mr. Stephanie Butnick, and your parents and your grandparents.
And we had a lot to drink.
We had Rocco's Tacos. I brought Rocco's Tacos. You had left
you
by then,
it.
Liel, but I bought.
Okay, can I tell the story that Liel spent the night at my parents' house in the extra bedroom and my dad the next morning was like, I walked out at like 7 a.m. when Liel said he had to leave. And I opened, like I knocked on the door to see if anyone was there. And I opened the door and it was like, no one had ever been in there. There was like a Mossad operation that took you out the ceiling or something.
There you have it.
There was no trace of him.
The bed was so perfectly
made.
Yeah,
like those military corners.
Yes. And the night before, I think I single-handedly consumed maybe 3/4 of the bottle of tequila. So that was great.
Yeah.
You guys are great.
It was like
Thank
a team
you.
Bonding adventure.
It was pretty great. And
we all miss... Rav Cookie.
Rav Cookie, who was the rabbi of Temple Israel in West Palm. What an experience. What architecture with the undulating ceiling, the light show.
I saw the pictures on Facebook from the Beatles Shabbat, and I think we missed out.
Yeah, the next week was a Beatles Shabbat. Yeah. The ocean view.
It will always be our Mar-a-Lago.
A special shout out to the youth group of Temple Israel who planted the Esrog trees in the garden that Rav Cookie showed us with great pride.
But so there's etrogim on the tree, but you can't eat it for like a few, or you can't pick a tree for a few years.
Yes.
So these kids are going to be like well out of college by the time
yes.
they can use
That's Jewish continuity for you.
That's Little news of the Jews. Omri Kaspi, the first Israeli to play in the NBA, reportedly is being traded from the Sacramento Kings. Is that a real team?
No, it's the Kings. Okay. I thought that was like a typo.
No, it was like from one of our Jew news sources. It is the Kings. Of course it's the Kings.
I knew so much that you would not even know the name.
Now that you say it, I realize it's the Kings.
It's actually the Sacramento Kine Bars.
That's where my brain was going. It was like, did some East Bay, I mean, Sacramento, really East Bay, did someone think like, that's called the Kines.
They're the Kine men.
And he was being traded to the New Orleans Pelicans. That's a team?
In the worst trade in NBA history.
Who was on the other half of the trade?
Let's not even go there. It takes a long time. But
you know where we are
going to
go is Hitler's telephone. Last week we talked about how it was on the auction block and we wondered what kind of sicko wanted to own it. Some sicko who paid $243,000. It was been sold to an unnamed bidder. So what this means is somewhere in the world you could walk into someone's house, you don't know whose, pick up one of those old ceramic cradled telephones and be getting Hitler cooties.
Although, to be perfectly honest, you would have to pay $200,000 membership fees because that's what Mar-a-Lago costs these days.
That was a good one.
What's amazing is you'd actually registered for Hitler's telephone and now you know, you may be getting it.
I just got a note from Bloomingdale's that it's like unavailable. It's right.
Although, maybe someone bought it.
Oh my God, that would be the nicest wedding present, guys. Thank you so much.
Stephanie, as our senior Drake correspondent, is there anything to be made of the fact that Drake played Cory Booker last week? He offered to the police to help stop a man from jumping off a bridge in England, but the police declined his help, which I see as a mistake because I feel like if you're about to end it all, the cop saying to you, stop. Doesn't do it, but it was Drake's magical celebrity appearing.
Yeah, it was like his tour bus or his posse or whatever they have these days. And there was like some traffic jam at 5 a.m. on a bridge. And it was because someone was trying to kill themselves. And like Drake was like, hey, man, like, do you think I can help? Like, and the guy's probably like, first of all, who are you? Second of all, like, no. It's like the most Drake thing to do to assume that he could be helpful in that situation.
I would like to point out.
It was a suicide hotline blink.
Oh my God, that was good. When did you think of it?
Right now.
I would like to point out we still don't know that Drake actually is a Toronto Jew. Remember when we went up to Toronto and tried to find out and we got emails from people?
Everyone knew a little bit about him.
Everyone was like, my third cousin went to summer camp, but
nobody got a good email from someone who's his mom's cousin that I've been keeping on the down low.
Not good enough for me. If that guy grew up in Toronto Jewish life, somebody would have actually met him once. Also, this is not a jerky thing to say. How many black kids are there at the Jewish events, right? Like you'd remember the extremely charismatic, talented, good dancing, good singing, future pop star black kid on the bar mitzvah circuit. It just strikes me as implausible that no one ever knew him.
So you think is this?
I think
fake
he's from
news?
Omaha. I think he's I think it's fake news. I think he's a Gentile from Omaha.
Wow.
Said it. Also in fake news this week, Trump. There was that press conference where he called on the Orthodox reporter who goes by the name of Jake Turks from Ami Magazine, the Haredi magazine in Brooklyn. And he told him to sit down and then he explained why he won by a lot of votes.
That was a different one.
Oh, yeah.
At the Netanyahu, he called him Ben Netanyahu the next day. But so at the Netanyahu presser, where they had a press conference before even talking, which is an amazing power move. Mm-hmm. Someone asked about anti-Semitism, and he was like, you would not believe how many electoral votes I got. It's like literally not the question. And then the next day, Jake Turks, who we know his name, I mean, it's not his real name, but it's his at least it's his Twitter handle, which is embroidered on his yarmulke, at Jake Turks.
It's a strong move, embroider your Twitter handle on your yarmulke.
Especially in like a press scrum situation. Like, so Trump thought he was getting an easy question. He basically got an easy question, which was, no one in my community, i.e. like the Orthodox community, has said anything about you being anti-Semitic. We know you're a Zaidi to Jewish grandchildren. Like, but just what are you going to do? What are you guys doing about like this uptick in anti-Semitic like action across the country? And he basically did like, told him to sit down. And then said, like, I'm
nobody
the least
likes,
anti-Semitic
nobody
person.
Nobody likes Jews more than me. Now sit down, you dirty Jew.
Basically. And then, I don't know if this was planned before or after, he dispatched Mike Pence to Dachau to take a tour.
Well, that's when you're in real trouble in the Trump administration.
he literally sends
you to the camps.
Sends you to the camps to take a tour. And my first reaction to this, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Reagan went to the – was it Bitburg? Was that the cemetery he went to? And like initially he wasn't going to – there's always like, did he visit Auschwitz? Would he not visit Auschwitz? Did he pay enough homage? Was there enough respect shown to the dead Jews? And I always feel like I don't really care if my American politicians visit concentration camps. Like that's actually not –
As long as they don't set up concentration camps, we're super
like a
cool.
Pretty low bar.
Yeah. Right, like I'd really rather that Mike Pence be here in America saying we care about all of the death threats being phoned in, all the bomb threats being phoned into JCCs, than him in Dachau with his wife and daughter.
We would never let a demagogue who accuses big, you know, problems in the world on small religious mind. Oh, hold on.
Oh wait. Yeah.
So
oh, wait.
It's but I think it's more meaningful because Pence is there in the midst of Trump literally like refusing to disavow. I mean, he did finally today. Tell a reporter that like anti-Semitism is bad. Those are like really what's that? Four words.
Well, wait, him, did
like,
he today?
He did. Yeah,
it wasn't
he did.
Just an Ivanka tweet saying
no.
We
it was
love
an Ivanka
everybody.
Tweet last night, and then he said he like confirmed finally that he feels that anti-Semitism is bad, and like we're going to stop
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Donald.
You're going to stop it.
So like it, because he didn't say that.
We are going to stop anti-Semitism. Very, very bad.
It started under Obama.
I inherited a mess.
Amy Carter used to tweet about it.
That's amazing. We are going to stop it. This is so great.
It'll be the most wonderful
okay,
stopping
so
of anti-Semitism.
Here's the thing, Jews. Here's a brand new bar. We're going to take the president at his word. Unless Donald Trump eradicates anti-Semitism, he would be a failure of a president.
Yep.
Speaking of anti-Semites.
Speaking of anti-Semites. In January, there were apparently 48 bomb threats phoned into Jewish community centers. It's February. There were a bunch more like yesterday. I will say at least one of the threats has been to my local JCC in New Haven, Connecticut. You know, this is very real. How worried should – what should we think of – I mean, part of me says there could be one crazy person with whitepages.com. Right, like it's not proof that America has gone insane.
I think that it's a canned call that I believe the idea is that it's one person doing a lot of these calls.
First, they came for the JCCs, but I did nothing because I didn't belong to the JCC. Right?
No, the second thing is because I didn't swim at the JCC. Right.
So my in-laws, God bless them, yeah, they go to the JCC to work out every right. day. Not, I think probably
they're like, the only Jews there. Right?
They're the only right. Jews there. These calls are probably arriving. They're closing the JCCs down, and a bunch of like you know Unitarians are like wait, why
am I going to play squash?
Why do we have to leave the
right.
pool
in New Haven? Like the JCC, right. God bless it, is the nursery school that has the best hours. So basically, if you need
That's
to
right.
work, if you can't do pickup till 6, it doesn't matter if you're Catholic, right. Lutheran, Muslim, JCC.
Right. Like, Mom, why do we have to go home at 3 p.m.? Makes no sense. Well, because someone hates the Jews.
Someone hates the
oh,
Jews.
That's
I mean,
messed
look,
up.
But look, the sad irony is, like, remember those Kansas shootings a few years ago? Those were outside several JCC-type places, and they literally killed, like, three right. non-Jews.
Gentiles, yeah.
And it's like, it's weird, though, because we always talk about how anti-Semites know so much about Jews, and it's like... They're getting it wrong here.
Right. Right. They've read the Talmud deeply to find like weird world
yeah,
conspiracy
like
plotting,
stuff.
But guys, they don't actually know where to find us.
If you really want to mess with us, go for like bakeries.
Yeah, like literally.
If you shoot up oar washers, like you're going to get me. But the JCC.
Yeah, like you'll get me at the bagel place.
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty much. Yeah. Or like.
I'm not going to tell you which one though.
We'd like to welcome some new subscribers to our newsletter. This week it's the law firm of Brad Pham, Rebecca, and Israel Hoffman, who listened to us on a recent trip driving around Samoa. Leonard Glass, Alex Zaslow, John Branson, Richard Vogel, and Michael Birm, Lauren Monaco, Shalom Staub, Killian Metcalf, and Jonathan Wenig. Brad Pham, I actually know something about.
Oh, I know Brad Pham.
You know Brad Pham?
Oh, yeah.
Brad Pham, actually, his great-grandfather was in the diamond industry between Brussels and London, and he was always cheating people, and they knew him as Baruch Scheister. And in London over the years, the family name eventually changed. When they anglicized it, it moved into Pham.
No, you're maligning the Pham.
And so that's the Pham family.
You're incorrect.
I am?
That's not the story.
Okay.
Well, Grandpa Pham was indeed a very wealthy man. He, little known fact, is the inventor of the ShamWow. Do you remember the ShamWow?
No.
Oh, yes.
What?
I don't. This is
you
a late night.
You don't want infomercials?
It's like up there with OxyClean.
That's exactly what it is.
The Flowbee?
That is exactly what it is.
Okay, what is it?
It's
like this cloth.
Yeah, it's the cloth
that cleans anything.
Absorbs everything. The ShamWow. And so, Baruch Sham.
So I have a different take.
Yeah.
Back in the old country, great-great-great-grandfather Sham invented what we now know as the European Sham, which is a different kind of pillow mm-hmm. to put on your bed. It's not that standard weird one. It's like a nice square.
Is this a real thing?
The European Sham?
Yeah. Oh, and they invented it?
And by the way, you know what their favorite holiday is? It's Hanukkah because they get to say Nes Gadol Hayah.
Sham. To get the newsletter, sign up at tabletmag.com or send an email asking for it to unorthodox@tabletmag.com.
Oh, if you would like three morons right. to make fun of your name.
It should be said, by the way, that some of you sign up by sending us an email and then we have your name. If you sign up through the portal on the web, we don't necessarily have your name. So then send us an email saying,
I mean, if you want to be made fun of, but like, yeah, you can also just sign up on our newsletter on each of the podcast pages.
Fun free.
Right.
Also, if you want to make fun of our names, like I'm fair game. Yeah. It really builds character.
What did people do to Butnick?
So here's the weird thing.
Because I'll tell you what they did to Oppenheimer.
I don't even know what they could have done to Oppenheimer.
I will tell you.
But so I'm S. Butnick, like S. Butnick a tablet. That's my email. So Sputnik. And I'm born in the late 80s.
But that's cool.
I just think that like, when you're a parent, like my initials are STB. My friend used to say it's one hump away from an STD. Which I thought was like pretty clever for eighth grade.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jen. So yeah, a lot of butt nick about butt lick, but like butt like butt stuff.
I would have gone butt lick, no doubt.
And yeah, it was fine. I'm fine.
Yeah,
between that and butt pick, I would say.
Well, how about this? My sister's Francesca Butnick, and so her nickname was Franny. So her 17 magazine subscription, which you started getting when you were like 13,
sure,
went to
and
Fanny.
Getting when you were 16,
went to Fanny Butnick, and for me, like 11-year-old me, it was the best.
What did anyone ever do anything to Leah Leibowitz?
Do you think someone would, and then live to tell the tale?
And then you would sit on
no,
them.
No, I would crush them.
What do you think they did to Oppenheimer?
I think they said, "Pop, he has enough." Problems. So leave him alone.
The kind ones did that.
He seems sad.
There was, I mean, the nice ones, my buddies, it was always Oppie, right? But
Moppenheimer,
Moppy, but Open Diaper was a big one.
Very nice.
That was sort of circa fifth clever. And sixth grade. Circa fifth and sixth grade was Open Diaper. I like that we're getting a laugh out of Paul at Argo Studios.
This is why you don't pun, by the way.
That's right.
You're like, no!
So Open Diaper was a big one. And then sort
my
of,
name, the source of so much ridicule.
Then more toward high school, and this is a not safe for work, there was... Oh, no, it was in college, actually. It was one of my old roommates who called me Popperheimen, which doesn't even really sound like Oppenheimer, but it's...
Or you know, if we're being
or
fair,
anything
really captures, I think,
relevant,
your
yeah.
essence. But okay.
Anyway.
But you're fine now.
Some would say. Friends, two very important announcements this week. Number one, there's still time to get your tickets for the Golem Show, March 23rd at Drom in the East Village. We've talked about this before. It's their fake wedding. It's a kind of reenactment of a thing that they used to do up in the Catskills. You can learn more at golemweddings.com/fake-wedding or go to dromnyc.com. It's on March 23rd, and we hope to see you there. Another really important announcement. There's a birthday in the house, the birthday this week of Warren Levinson, father of our producer, Noah A. Levinson.
Warren, you done good.
Should I sing him happy birthday like Marilyn Monroe did?
But JFK? In Hebrew.
Yeah.
Happy birthday. I actually just want to hear the two of you sing in Hebrew.
Yom.
Okay.
Yom huledet samea. Is that all the words in the song?
Yeah. This is what 30 yeah. years of combined Hebrew school sound like, everybody.
And I thought it was Yom halevet, but it's
Yom halevet.
I actually...
Jesus Christ.
I got Monday, Wednesday migraines, which really interfered with my after-school Hebrew learning. Uh-huh. Just ask my family.
Look, the important thing is my daughters will know this. All right? That's called tradition.
That's what Jewish continuity.
What I forget, the daughters
will
know.
I know fuck all, anyway, but my daughters will.
Anyway, Warren Levinson,
we love
thank you.
HBD.
Thank you for giving us Noah. And our listeners, thank you, too.
Our first Jew of the Week is Scott Feinberg, the awards columnist for The Hollywood Reporter and the host of the Awards Chatter podcast, on which he's interviewed Hollywood royalty like Morgan Freeman, Meryl Streep, and Steven Spielberg. He has one of the best track records for forecasting the Oscars, and the New York Times called him one of the most informed Oscarologists. Most important, he went to Brandeis with my brother-in-law, Cliff Silverman.
Really?
Yes. Oh, welcome, God. Scott. Thanks for being here.
Scott, Stephanie's been very excited about the fact that you went to Brandeis with her brother-in-law. Is there, in fact, a Cliff Silverman? Do you remember him?
Cliff Silverman is one of the most wonderful people I know. I was on the tennis team with Cliff Silverman, and I'm still in touch with him.
Yeah, of course. You were at their wedding, right?
I was, and I love those guys.
Did you predict that wedding, by the way?
I would not have predicted. I love Cliff, but I think he outdid himself with his wife. She's terrific.
So, Scott, I'm really excited to have you on, obviously. So you're kind of like the Nate Silver of Oscar predictions.
Well, thank you. I would have taken that as a great compliment before the 2016 presidential election.
Oh, yeah, we're just pretending that didn't happen. But film is so subjective. How do you make your picks? Are there polls and numbers? Is it a gut feeling? What's your secret sauce?
So the big thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the Academy members are divided into 17 branches. So there's the actors, the writers, the directors, the sound people, and on and on and on. And they only get to nominate, all of them get to nominate for Best Picture, but also then only in their specific, only in the categories that apply to their specific areas. So let's say you're a sound guy. You get to nominate for Best Picture and then for Best Sound Editing and Best Sound Mixing because, reasonably enough, those are the areas of expertise for you. But then somehow, for whatever reason, it's just sort of a long tradition of the Academy, everyone then gets to vote for everything once the nominees have been determined. And so as a result, you know, the vast majority of people who vote for the winners really don't know anything about sound editing or sound mixing. They're costume designers and visual effects people and, you know, people from all these other areas of the Academy. So when you're making, this is just an example of what you have to factor in when you're making these predictions, because when 94% of the Academy who are going to pick that award don't know anything about sound, it doesn't really matter what the sound community thought was the best. It's more a psychological exercise of figuring out, all right, for somebody who doesn't know anything about sound, what are they most likely to gravitate towards?
And so you're really into this, aren't you? Let me ask you this, though. Since you know, when I was young, some years ago now, the movies that were up for Best Picture and were in the Oscar running were movies everybody would have seen. They were big blockbuster movies. You just had to mention the name.
Out of Africa.
Everyone saw these movies, right? And now it's like Manchester by the Sea or Moonlight, which is like three people maybe saw in some art house in, like, you know, Connecticut. First of all, is that right? And second of all, why is this happening? And third of all, should we just, like, start giving Oscars to, like, the best Star Wars sequel or adaptation?
Well, there probably never has been a bigger divide between what the general public likes and what the Academy likes. But I think that's the result of the trend of the industry towards you know, all of the studios now are part of giant conglomerates to which they have to, you know, show profits or somebody's going to lose their job. In the old days, you know, Warner Brothers was run by the Warner Brothers, for instance, and all the studios had, you know, were essentially independent. And then when that stopped being the case, what happens is anything original or risky or edgy becomes a gamble that people who run these studios are afraid to take.
But then why do those small movies get put up? Why are those the Oscar winners now?
Well, because the people who make movies who are not running the studios necessarily are, they hope to champion those kind of movies in the hope that they don't entirely go away. Because without the motivation of trying to get Oscars or make money that comes from, you know, the attention of getting nominated for or winning an Oscar, these movies probably wouldn't get made. And so all you would have all year would be the remake sequels and adaptations of pre-existing stuff that already dominates the other three quarters of the year.
And the Oscar for Best Ninja Turtle sequel goes to...
So what do we have to look forward to at the Oscars this year? Give us, like, some things that you think are going to happen.
You're going to have a lot of La La Land love there.
A lot of blah, blah, blah.
Did you see it, Leo?
A lot of blah, yeah.
Yeah, I liked it.
It was fine. It was cute.
Despite myself.
3 stars.
Well, just remember that the reason that it's probably going over better with Academy members than with any other audience in the world is that it basically says, hey, all of you people who moved out to Hollywood and took a chance and, you know, struggled and then you made it.
And then danced a little.
Look what you had to go through. Aren't you terrific? And so that's sort of what it's... you know, it really resonates with them for that reason. So that's going to do very well. You're going to have some unbelievable musical performances there where you've got the best song nominees include songs that will be performed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, Justin Timberlake, Sting, plus the La La Land people. So you'll have some good entertainment there. And then you could have some very emotional speeches and moments. You know, Viola Davis is going to win Best Supporting Actress, and there's not a better speech maker in the business, so she'll have something to say. And you might also end up having probably Emma Stone win Best Actress, probably Mahershala Ali for Best Supporting Actor, and these are also you know, people who have amazing personal stories. And then there's the possibility of either Casey Affleck or Denzel Washington winning Best Actor, and if Casey wins, that's, you know, he may finally address the thing that's been sort of dogging him all season, which are these, you know, legal troubles of the past that were dredged up to probably hurt him. Or Denzel would, you know, would become one of only like two or three men who have ever won 3 acting Oscars. This would be his 3rd. So you'll have some really exciting winners as well this year.
So do you think the speeches are going to be political? Like, did what we see Meryl Streep do, like, are we going to see that from everyone?
I don't know about everyone, but I think you will definitely hear the name Donald Trump a few times during the evening on Sunday. And it's actually not been discouraged by the Academy. They used to really get angry when people brought politics into the Oscars, but at this point, truthfully, they just want ratings more than anything. And if that gets people tuning in either out of support or anger at what people are saying, then it's a win for them. So I think that you won't see someone, you know, cut off just because they bring up Trump or something like that.
So let me ask you this. Every year we have an Oscar party. Every year I print out those idiotic forms. And every year I come in, you know, either last or like second to last. Are there any tricks? Like, for example, you know, always bet on the Holocaust-themed movie if there is one to win. Like, what are the tricks that lay people should know getting Oscar bets right?
I mean, I don't know that there are too many things like that. And to be honest, with the Holocaust trick, which I've been burned on the past by betting
the Holocaust?
Against the Holocaust movie.
Yet another victim of the Holocaust.
I know. No, oh, God.
All of us are.
Well, but there is one this year. It's in the documentary short category. It's called Joe's Violin. But I actually am gonna. I'm leaning against picking that one. But there are. You know, you just have to kind of either know these things or not. You can spitball, and sometimes you'll actually get it right. Whereas the person that's trying to go in there with all this background will not get it right. Sometimes there's no explanation for some outcomes, you know, where they just defy all of the stats and things that we have at our disposal. But, you know, you just try to make the most informed prediction that you can. And then after that, it's in the hands of these roughly 7,000 people who, if you act, you know, like many members of the general electorate, if you just kind of chatted with them, you might be surprised that this is who you have entrusted these outcomes that we put so much, you know, stock in. Not everyone's the most impressive, but that's the way it works here.
But luckily, it's the popular vote for the Oscars.
Hey, right. Scott, who's like an up-and-coming Oscar prognosticator? Like, do you have a little mini-me, someone you're mentoring who's made some good calls but hasn't quite arrived yet?
You know, if that person is out there, I am not going to give them any attention because they're it's a competitive business here, guys.
So you've talked to pretty much like every Hollywood megastar for your podcast, Awards Chatter. Who are you most starstruck to interview?
You know, not at this point. I hope this comes across in the way I intended, but it's not a matter of being starstruck as much as wanting to make the most of the time you have with this person, because usually it's a set time, so you'll have an hour or whatever with that person, and you want to go in there just super prepared and then hope that it ends up being a good conversation. So for me, somebody who I'd, you know, to bring this back to Jews here, Jerry Seinfeld is somebody who I'd been told was not the warmest guy in the world, and that I better come with my ducks in a row for that conversation. And I did, and he ended up being terrific. So I think it's more a challenge of what can you make of these.
Who was a total dick?
Well, I'm willing to say one name here only because it was completely miserable, and that was Vanessa Redgrave. This wasn't for the podcast, and to be honest, I don't know how many Jews will be surprised to hear that.
The anti-Semite, yeah.
But you know, she was, I think, egged on by her publicist to send me an apology email afterward just for being so difficult. So you know, she's not entirely irredeemable, but it was just a very unpleasant conversation.
Vanessa Redgrave, not entirely irredeemable.
The Jews.
Sincerely, the Jews.
So if we want to play a drinking game this year, like what should it be? Drink every time someone says what or something happens or La La
Land.
Well,
I think you might want to do something every time you hear Trump. But
definitely.
Also, you know, probably La La Land will get you drunk pretty quickly.
Or do a shot. Do a shot anytime someone mentions a movie you've seen, in which case you'll do no shots.
No shots whatsoever.
So where will you be Oscar night?
I will be in the audience.
And are you like so stressed? Are you tallying things? Like what's going on in your mind?
You know, at that point, I'm pretty much just
wasted.
Spent, you know, in one sense, or, you know, if not all, I will be pretty wasted. But, you know, to find yourself in the audience is—it's just something mostly where just try to pinch yourself a little bit and remember that this was literally nothing more than a dream. You just never thought it was possible. So I'm very lucky and appreciative of the opportunity to do this and to be there.
So more importantly, what happens the day after? Like, do you go on vacation?
Well, so first, before you can get to the day after, or what bleeds into the day after, is everything that happens on Oscar night after the show lets out. So they have, you know, there's a lot of different parties which are of varying degrees of quality depending on who won. You know, most people kind of gravitate towards the winners, which can make for a a little bit of a lukewarm party for the poor people that, that didn't get anything. But anyway, it's very, you know, everybody's out after that. Everybody's breathing sort of a sigh of relief just that it's all over, because it's really the culmination of 6 months of stuff. And then the next day, you know, I always say I could probably be dead at my desk, and it might take a week before somebody noticed, because at that point, my value to, you know, my publication, to my readers, it's pretty much over. Most people just
nobody cares for the next few months.
We will still love you in the morning, Scott. Well, it's important to us to say that.
Hey, Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Great chatting with you. We'll obviously be following along with you. So to follow along with Scott Feinberg's Oscar predictions, follow him on Twitter at Scott Feinberg. Check out his column, The Race, at The Hollywood Reporter, and subscribe to his podcast, Awards Chatter, on iTunes. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, no upcoming live shows at the moment, but if you think you might want one in your community, email Alyssa at egoldstein@tabletmag.com. Also, if you're interested in advertising on Unorthodox, I've gotten a couple inquiries about this. I don't sell ads, but you know who does? Desiree Harrison Brown. And you can email her at desiree.harrison-brown@panoply.fm. Or just write to me, moppenheimer@tabletmag.com, and I will hook you up.
I think you mean M open diaper.
Yeah.
mopyourhymen@tabletmag.com, and I will
very troubling
you up. All right, to the mailbox. A bunch of good things.
To the mailbox.
To the mailbox. Hi, Mark. Greetings from Toronto, where we're still basking in the glow of last November's show at Beth Sedek. I just finished listening to the Valentine's Day episode and enjoyed the shout out for the mezuzah in the Google ad. In the Google ad. Here's a similar vignette. In 2009, Canadian filmmaker Adam Egoyan directed a movie called Chloe, starring Julianne Moore. It wasn't a box office smash, but it was filmed in and around Toronto, with many scenes filmed in our home. One of the location directors suggested removing the mezuzot from outside and inside the house. Egoyan adamantly refused. And to top that, there's a scene with Liam Neeson in his study, and on the bookshelf behind him is a biography of Ben-Gurion. As if! Thought you might find that amusing. That was from Alan Caney in Toronto. Thanks, Dr. Caney. Great to hear from you. Thanks for bringing us to Toronto. Bring us back. We'd love to come back. Another nice letter. Dear Mark, Stephanie, and Liel, I was very touched by Mark's story at the end of JJ's life. It's not just because I'm a dog person. When my grandmother was 89 years old, my husband, our one-year-old son, and myself lived on the other half of her double house. During her last days, we had a nurse come in to evaluate whether we could manage her care safely. As we talked with the nurse, my dad volunteered to go to the store to get adult diapers, as we sadly planned how to get through the night until she could be moved. Just before my dad came home, the nurse checked on her and told us that she was dead. When my dad returned, he had brought some fancy ice cream from our favorite shop. My husband was amazed as we sadly dished out the ice cream and ate it. I tried to explain to my husband that it was the same as another family might open cans of beer. To this day, he will occasionally ask me, "Are you going to eat ice cream when I die?" Of course, if I'm honest, the answer is always yes. Thanks for being the congregation that never asks for tickets, even on the high holidays. Lori Sandler, Canada. It's amazing. I mean, absolutely. There's no reason not to have ice cream.
No.
I mean, we are the people that eats at Chivas. Like,
we are the living.
We are the living. Next up, a letter from my brother Jonathan, who is expecting a daughter in September. He and his wife Britta.
Mazel
tov. So little Isaac will have a sister, so mazel tov. He writes, "What's up, homies? You three are good shits, and I apologize for my first email to you not being an expression of my gratitude for keeping me company on my long walks with my little man and my pup. Rest in playfulness, JJ. But as your resident Midwest expert, and given Liel's apparent view that everything Midwest takes place either in Wisconsin or Minnesota, two states in which I've spent a combined 12 years, I cannot let stand your comment that Reince Priebus is from Minnesota. The demise of political sanity and optimism and general decency in the cheese state, which now counts Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, and a guy named Ron Johnson as its well-known leaders, alongside the openly gay and respectable Tammy Baldwin, coincided with the rise of Priebus to national prominence. And we in Minnesota take small comfort knowing that he is not one of our own. No, we in Minnesota are the land of Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar and Paul Wellstone and a billionaire governor who taxed the rich and turned around a huge deficit into a $1.3 billion surplus. Don't get me wrong, we have a lot of awful anti-immigrant racists in our midst, but for the time being, the majority of Minnesotans have a soul, and we're happy to let our neighbors to the east claim the Reince now and forever. Peace, Jonathan Oppenheimer."
Well, in all fairness,
Joppenheimer.
Being a condescending East Coast liberal elitist, I only say Minnesota because that's the only name of a Midwestern state I know. I assume there are more, but like, it's just a catch-all for Midwest.
So there you go, Jonathan.
So write us again, Jonathan. Because now he's doubled down.
Yeah.
It's called the Trump.
It is.
Two more letters. Hey, J. Crew. So this is our writer who's giving us.
It's a thing now.
J. Crew.
We're actually more of like a Madewell crowd.
It's Ben from Philly here, and I'm a recent convert to unorthodoxy and making my way through old episodes. I wanted to shout out my older sister, Paula, who got me hooked on your podcast. She's getting smicha, that's ordination, from Jewish Theological Seminary this spring, and I would love to completely embarrass her on your show. She's currently interviewing for pulpit positions, and so to all the shuls that interview her, she's an absolute catch, a true mensch, and you'd be lucky to have her. Tov Yalabai, Ben from Philly.
So listen, anyone who's interviewing Paula for a pulpit job right now,
you would be fools not to hire her.
That's exactly right. If you do not hire Paula, you hate the Jewish people.
And better yet, if you do hire her, we'll give you a shout out on the show.
We totally would.
Free advertising for you. Finally, from Linda Magid. No, she says pronounced like magic, but with a hard G. From Linda
Magid.
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 Magid. But with Magid? A hard G.
Magid.
She writes, hi, if Stephanie hasn't already thought of it, she must make David Duchovny's, hello, Stephanie, a ringtone. It was hot.
It was amazing. It was like the best half second of my life. Hey, Stephanie. Was it hi, Stephanie? Hey, Stephanie.
Hey, Stephanie. It is, yeah. Total ringtoning that one.
But it's only for when he calls, which happens like all the time now. I'm like, Duchovny, chill.
Hi, Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie.
Our second Jew of the Week is Molly Yeh, the author of Molly on the Range, one of the New York Times' top fall cookbook releases of 2016. She is also the creator of the food blog My Name is Yeh, which was Savor's 2015 Blog of the Year. She is also a Juilliard-trained percussionist and has performed with orchestras around the world. And there's more.
No,
Yep.
What tops Juilliard-trained percussionist?
She lives on a sugar beet farm on the North Dakota-Minnesota border. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
And we have to describe to our listeners before we even begin this conversation.
You are the first Jewish guest to like bring us food.
Not only did you bring us food.
That's
the Gentiles
brought us
food. Yeah. Duo Dickinson brought us liquor.
Yeah, the Gentiles are supposed to bring you food, I thought.
Listen, I have to describe what I'm looking at. So these are not only the most beautiful hamantaschen you have ever seen with like beautiful, colorful sprinkles in the middle. They're also individually wrapped, and they're tied together with this perfect, like, candy stripe, red and white bow. And they're in this perfect wooden box.
Can I have one now, or is this about three months to put together this display?
But well, now I'm going to eat it.
So I'm not breaking up with all different kinds of sprinkles, and I need your help in like figuring out which sprinkles are the best because
we're super good at that.
I have a collection of sprinkles.
I feel like
that's weird.
All you can hear right now is the crinkling of these packets.
Yeah. What are they stuffed with?
There's a layer of strawberry jam, and then marzipan. And then they're topped with sprinkles.
Oh my god,
Leo likes them.
Before we get into all this stuff, you're half Jewish.
Wait, can I ask a question?
Sorry.
So I just have a whole thing prepared, but I want to open these.
Wait, can I say that I'm very starstruck right now, and I almost didn't come because I look forward to listening to Unorthodox every week, and it's my routine. On Thursday nights, I go to the gym and I lift weights, and I just laugh hysterically as I'm listening to you guys on Thursday nights. But I realize though,
you go to the LA Fitness in North Dakota.
I go to the town gym and lift my weights.
Oh, for sure.
Oh yeah. But I realize though, since I don't like listening to my own voice, I can't.
We'll
listen to it.
When you're a top Savor, when Savor calls you a top blogger, it's time for you to accept the limelight.
Thank you.
Okay. So I feel like some sugar. Everyone got a little sugar, and everyone's just like off the rails. Okay. So on your blog's FAQ section, one of the first questions you have listed, which you wrote yourself, is: "You look funny. What's your ancestry?" As you explain, your father is Chinese and your mother is Jewish. But is that something that people have actually said to you? What are you?
All the time. People will just look at me for like a second. Not so much anymore since it's like 2017. And it's like,
you can't do that anymore.
But back when I lived in Brooklyn in like 2012, people would look at me and kind of like,
but in Brooklyn, everyone looks like you. That's kind of weird.
It was weird. And then not only would
you're half Asian, half Jewish and live in Brooklyn?
And then they would also argue with me and be like, no, you're not half Asian, half Jewish. You're Italian or you're Mexican or you're Latina. It's It was a big conversation.
What is that like? Were you? What's the mix of offense taken, annoyingness, flattery? Like, what were your? What was the complex of emotions behind answering that question?
Now, so I actually just got a question yesterday when I posted the Hamantaschen on Instagram. Somebody said, "Are you Jewish?" With like a what is that called? The question mark and the exclamation point.
That's what it's called.
No, there's a
is
name.
Is there another
there's
name,
a name for it?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
Interrobang.
You're a word nerd, aren't you?
I love words. But so I was like a little bit taken aback because, yeah, it's like it's 2017 and like Jews look like this now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when in the dating scene, though, it was weird. I would date these guys who like in Juilliard, like everybody has yellow fever because there are so many Asian girls.
Well,
there.
You kind of have to, right?
Yeah. Like, so
if you didn't have it when you got there.
Yeah. So,
men are all gay, right? So it's like three straight guys and a lot of Asian women.
Yeah. It's like, it's a ball for them. Yeah. So, I would go on these dates and like, and, you know, it would just be kind of like surfacey, like first date, small talking, whatever. And then when it would eventually come out that I was Jewish, they would suddenly have this switch in tone, like, suddenly, it wasn't just like a casual date. It was, do you want to get married and come and meet my parents next weekend?
I mean, it's offensive Mm-mm. because they were disrespecting the age. They were fetishizing the Asianness.
Right.
But wasn't it a ratcheting up of the level of respect?
Well, there were some instances where it was just presented in like a very offensive way. And then another instance where like this guy who we actually like became boyfriend, girlfriend and dated for a while.
Mm-hmm. Is he the meatless balls guy?
Yes.
Okay. See, in the cookbook, there's a recipe from him, yeah, from his mom.
The vaguely macho vegan Philly guy.
Right.
Yeah. Yikes.
Because if you want to be known as anything, as the meatless balls guy.
So let's talk about Juilliard.
Okay.
Explain how you got there, what you did there. Was it all like Whiplash? Like, how real is that movie? Was that your life?
I mean, it was obviously like very much blown out of proportion and very Hollywoodized, but there were some elements in it that like hit me like
the
in
blood.
The stomach. I was like, not so much the blood, but like the being singled out in the middle of an orchestra where like you're made to play something over and over and over in front of everybody else. So probably like 2 or 3 years into Juilliard, as I'm like spending a majority of my time in rehearsals waiting for my one triangle note and then never getting to have my triangle note, I was thinking like, I can't do, I need to be doing something else.
Well, a cookie would be great right about now.
Well, so like I discovered like how much fun it was to bake cookies. And
that when did you get into cooking?
Well, I got my first apartment my third year, and it had like this tiny itsy bitsy kitchen. And I just kind of like discovered how much fun it was to bake cupcakes, because that was something that from the start to the finish I could make, and it was a physical thing. And even if I was sitting in a kitchen for 4 hours and I failed, like I still had like an edible object that like is sugary and buttery. And
you had your triangle. Like you had the ring.
Right.
Got it.
If I like fail after like 4 hours of being in triangle rehearsal, like I haven't done anything.
I want to get to the part where you moved to a farm.
From the tiny tiny apartment kitchen to like the most beautiful farm kitchen I've ever seen in my entire life. How'd you get there?
I fell in love with a farmer. That's like
how do you meet a farmer?
That's old fashioned. Yeah.
What's a nice farmer doing at Juilliard?
FarmersOnly.com.
I did once date a farmer, but she was a farmer who'd moved to the big city and like the family.
No, her last name was Farmer.
Was Farmer, yeah. Right?
She's an accountant.
Well, Nick, my husband, he is a trombone player and he came to Juilliard. So he was at Juilliard the whole time, but he was very quiet. And that was like a rowdy percussionist. So for the few years that we overlapped at Juilliard, we were just sort of like, we knew who each other was and we were kind of in the same friend group, but I never saw him at parties. We never really like hung out. And also I was dating the meatless balls guy. So
could you explain that for our listeners? Could you explain that for our listeners?
So
it's a recipe.
It's a recipe because my ex-boyfriend, his mom made these amazing meatless meatballs that remain in my life as like his legacy in my life. So this is a recipe that I continue to make.
We're actually going to try them at our vegetarian house.
Yeah, it's walnut, toasted walnuts and garlic and Parmesan cheese and breadcrumbs, and you just mm-hmm. grind it up and you fry it. Kind of like an Italian spiced falafel.
Well, that metaphor will help.
I have a lot. Thank you. I have a lot of respect for you. I am never going to make that.
So you head to the farm.
I'll make meat.
And then you're like, shoot, there's no triangle work around here. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm qualified to do.
The freelance scene in Grand Forks for classical music is not what it
Sleepy.
Is in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I So at the time, okay, so we moved there like 3.5, 4 years ago, and I got a job at the town bakery working the 1 a.m. bakery shift. And then meanwhile, Nick was going to Harvest, so he was working like 18 hours or something ridiculous.
So this is his family's farm.
This is his family's farm, yeah.
Sugar
and
beets.
At what point did he say to you, like, by the way,
we're moving home, babe.
Yeah.
We both, okay, so I went home for Passover, like, the last year that I was living here, and I really liked it. I really, like, for the first time after, like, moving to New York, I realized how much I loved kind of, like, having space and having a yard and having, like, trees around and everything.
Amen.
So, like, and the Midwest.
And the Midwest. So like, I flew back. The first words out of my mouth to Nick were, I want to leave New York. And he said, me too. And so we just kind of were, like, weighing our options. And he said, by the way, my family has this farm. And, like, I'm thinking, living in Brooklyn, I'm thinking, cool, like, pickling, wearing unironic plaid flannel.
Artisanal t-shirts.
Yeah, exactly. Like, having chickens, all that stuff. Right. Like, very romantic farm. Like, wake up at sunup, walk barefoot through the fields.
Dry
like,
some spices.
Or whatever. Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, cool, yeah. Like, I'm going to move there whether you're with me or not. And so he was like, all right, that works. And we just did it. And then, and so when I was living there, so we got there and I was like, all right, like, where are all of your friends?
That you like grew up with, like,
let's hang out with people. Yeah, so like he didn't have any friends because like all of his best friends are his family, and so I just had all this free time and I worked on the blog. I worked on the photographs mainly, and then through that was able to just kind of like grow a following.
What? Let's talk manual labor, because like what? Like, did you get to the farm and they were like, okay, now you gotta like get those eggs? Like, were there things you had to do that you were not expecting?
Stephanie didn't even know what a farm thing to say was.
did you
shuck that cow? did you milk that
cow? Shucking on the kibbutz is very big. I was an expert.
Tell me farm things.
Okay, so it was a lot of getting used to bugs. I was confronted with death a few times, like, of animals. But manual labor, though, I mean, like, when I first got there, they were like, all right, you have this yard now. Are you going to mow the lawn? And I got on the mower. And at this point, like, I hadn't driven in years. I almost let my, like, driver's license, it could have, like, expired.
Oh, it's a fun, like, riding mower. Oh, love those.
Yeah, it's one of the riding mowers. Yeah, so I started to do it. I did it for one day, and I was like, I can't do this.
Your legs were sore from that. You have to press so hard.
And I was like afraid
of
the sun, and it was like noisy and it was bumpy, and there was like grass flying into my mouth.
So your husband farms full time?
He farms full time, yeah.
What does he farm?
Sugar beets.
Oh, sugar beets, right, yeah.
Yeah, and soybeans too. So
I'm really more worried for him, right? Because that's a tough life.
He loves it, and He, like the physical labor, I think he's like super into, and he gets this like gnarly farmer's tan every year.
Oh,
and then,
it's hot. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But does he listen to podcasts while he's doing it?
Oh, yes. And I just got him going on Unorthodox.
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
I'll listen to this.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Now look, Molly, you're famous now. When are you coming back? When are you leaving the farm?
Oh,
you're like, way too big for
like when am I
Dakota
moving? No, I love it there. No, you know, seriously, come and do a live Unorthodox show in Grand Forks.
I think we should. I would love that.
I will get live the three other town Jews to.
That's what they call them.
Are there town Jews there?
The whole Havara will come?
There's actually a history. There used to be a huge Jewish community in Grand Forks.
Now, wait a second. Now, you mean there used to be a Jewish community in Town Forks?
It's smaller than Fargo's population, larger than Bismarck's.
Whoa.
And so the
put
Jews
that
now
on a bumper sticker.
So we have like an itsy bitsy synagogue, and then the liquor store in town, like the big liquor store, is owned by
the Jays.
Town Jews.
The Jews.
Yeah. Amen.
The sinners.
Yeah.
So your father's Chinese, your mother's Jewish. Did you grow up with any sort of fusion, like food fusion of the holidays? Like, what are your what are your early food memories?
We had a lot of dumplings, so like matzo balls and steamed Chinese buns, and like pot stickers, but made with chicken, not pork. And so there were just like it was a lot of carbs, very carb heavy. And then I was also kind of. My mom was like never sort of one to like put boundaries on things. So if like I wanted to make a fusion thing, so like there's like the scallion pancake challah in my book. Like my mom was like all for that type of thing, and she was the type of mom who like never gave me coloring books. She always gave me like blank pages and like make your own lines.
So free range.
Yeah, very free range. And so you know, if I wanted to buy Oreos at the store, it was like, why would you buy Oreos and you can make them from scratch?
And look at you now.
Yeah, so it was fun.
Have you encountered that brand that's in my supermarket called Soyve? Which is
That at our town Target.
Which is offensive,
which is offensive on so many levels.
Is it good?
I've never tried. No real Jew would buy Soyve. Okay. But I think it is kosher. I mean, I think they're making, you know, soy sauce that's Jewy or something. I don't know.
And your book is full of, you know, like Middle Eastern. There's a lot of challah recipes. There's a lot of falafel. It's pretty Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, it's weird because like I went to one cookbook store last week in Montreal and it was in the Jewish book section. And I took a lot of pride
in that. I think it's actually called the Jewish book ghetto.
It was in,
and
like,
you like that?
I loved it. Okay. Yeah, because it's yeah, kind of rides this border of like, you know, is this a Jewish book? Like, should this be on Hanukkah gift guides?
Yes.
Or is
yes.
it not Jewish?
Are there
enough?
More Absolutely. Jews in Grand Forks Rapids? Where are you from? What's the town?
Grand Forks.
Grand Forks, or more Asian Americans? Which makes you more of a minority there?
And which do you feel is more offensive to the local races? Do they hate you more because you're Jewish or because you're Asian?
Well, I mean, I think because I look Asian, I stand out more.
Right. But if they found out you're also Jewish, which would offend them more?
They're so nice.
Like, even the racists there are
they're
nice.
All so
sorry, but
nice.
Don't like you. Sorry
no.
to offend.
You don't do that. Like, it's they approach it with, like, curiosity and, like, and... they just ask a lot of questions about both Judaism and like Asian culture. And so it's like, on one hand, it's like, I mean, it's like, it's really nice, but it's also like, okay, I very clearly like, we have to come to a center point here and like figure out like what things are common from my culture and your
How
culture.
How do you handle the earnestness and the lack of irony on the Great Plains?
I listen to you. I'm serious. Like, I have to...
When you need a sarcasm...
We're basically your advice, is what you're saying. Instead of smoking or drinking heavily.
I am dead serious. Yeah. It is. Yeah, it's like people are just are very, Jews. Like, well-behaved, and you don't offend there. It's like, it's pretty, like, G-rated, and, like, you don't say something that, like, your grandma wouldn't want you to say. And so, yeah, so I have to just, like, turn on Liel.
Like, shalom, fuckers.
Yeah.
We should do a live show.
I'm totally there. I want to say, though.
What we should do is a road trip. We need to
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I want to say, I feel like you have it figured out because you seem very calm. Like, you seem very, you've probably been in very high intensity environments, like in Juilliard and these orchestras, but like, you have this calmness. And I feel like I want to go there and I want to make the things that you make in the pretty pictures.
You want her serenity and her humentation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, see, but then you open the book and be like, I want to make the thing in the pretty pictures. But then you read, like, the talent and the skill required for it. Like,
oh yeah.
Get it.
Or I could order out. Or I could go to
get it.
But you can't order out. That's the thing.
That's the thing. There's no seamless.
Your mom is like, no, we have to make Oreos.
Yeah.
I actually want to say, because when you're saying you want her life, I first heard about you from this article in The Cut that was called I Want This Bitch's Life. And it was about her. And it was like, I was like, oh my God, I do. So can you just like call us each week and just like say nice things and like tell us what's going on?
I'll just start like the opposite podcast of Unorthodox for people who are from the Midwest and who live in New York and need like some old for cute.
That will be, it'll like be some, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And
it should
niceness.
Be called Orthodox.
Some
just be like, hi.
Like, to get into
news,
something.
News of the Nachos today.
To get into something.
It's
just called news.
Everybody's getting along.
To get a weak facsimile of your mental state, Liel here meditates every morning. I mean, you know
and
what?
Every
you,
afternoon.
You know what you don't need? Meditation. You live you live a meditative state.
No, that's
state.
Not true. Everybody needs meditation.
No, I don't. You need therapy. Like, you think I need meditation. I think you need therapy.
A lot of people think that.
What's your favorite recipe in this book?
Okay, so the lefse in there. Lefse is their answer to the latke. I don't know if it like actually was their answer, but it's their holiday potato pancake, meaning like
their
the,
meaning North
Dakotans. Sorry, that's so mean of me.
The goyim.
I have to make sure not to offend them. But
they're not listening.
Upper Midwest, Scandinavian people of Norwegian.
That's their latke. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so you know, you think of latkes, you think of like. Drinking a beer, like getting drunk, like oils splattering everywhere, like people are having a great big party when they're making latkes. Lefse is you get together with four church ladies in the basement of the Lutheran church, and you have one lady that's rolling out the dough so that it's paper thin. It's like you can almost see through it. And it's just basically like white potatoes and flour and sugar. And then you have one lady who's using a big, long wooden stick to transfer it to a big grill. And the stick has hopefully been in your family for like four generations, that type of thing. Or you get it for a wedding.
It's the only thing they brought over from Norway.
Exactly.
Is the lefse stick.
Is the lefse stick. The sacred lefse stick. And then you have one lady who's like flipping it. And they say that if you can't flip a lefse, then like you're going to have like problems in your marriage or something like that.
Your children like, will have cleft palates if you can't flip a lefse, right?
Yeah. So it's like a very challenging thing to make. And so when I first made it, I thought, you know, like I can do this. I have a recipe. This is going to be easy. It's just potatoes and you like flip it. And I made it with sweet potatoes. I didn't rice the potatoes, which I learned you absolutely have to do. And it was like it was a complete disaster. I was like on the phone crying with great, great Aunt Ethel. And I was not only questioning my ability to make this seemingly simple potato pancake, but I had just moved to Grand Forks and I was like questioning my future as a Midwestern farm wife.
As a Lutheran church lady.
So it's basically, it's made, to make it, you basically have a quilting bee for latkes.
Exactly.
So I stand with our producer, Lisa Goldstein, who holds that the latke is pretty much one of the worst food stuffs ever. This is, by the way, the only thing that
she has to meet my ex-boyfriend's dad.
The meatless balls guy.
Yeah, because his dad made really great latkes.
Meatless balls. But my question is this. When you, because the lefse really sounds like the only thing that might be like actually worse than the latke. and be honest here, do you have disdain for the culinary tradition you've moved into? Because here you are coming from these like super very like just really
Chinese, Jewish,
like very
spices.
And I was like, take the potato,
lutefisk.
We put the whole Garrison Keillor, for sure. Put the flour and the sugar, and we take the selfie or the lefse stick.
Walter Mondale for sure.
Yeah, there's not a lot of salt. Like I had to literally bring. My own kosher salt to my mother-in-law's house. There's nothing spicy. Like, so
There's no voice. It's like, what's wrong with you people inside your head?
Not anymore. It's too nice.
She's gone native.
Yeah, I've gone soft.
Okay, final question. What have you done to solve the bagel problem in your life?
I have a bagel teacher in town. He recently moved.
That's why you're actually here in New York. Oh, you mean in North Dakota?
He recently moved from Pennsylvania. He's a professor at the UND. And this summer I'm going on a fishing trip to Alaska for salmon. And so I'm going to go get some salmon. I'm going to make some lox. And then Dave, my bagel friend, is going to come over and teach me how to make bagels.
When Mollier makes bagels and lox.
She does not mess around.
She dishes her own lox in Alaska.
I think it's like a big deal when I like wait on the Russ and Daughters line.
That's
like,
exactly right.
I am enduring. I earned it.
Sometimes I go to Absolute Bagels like five blocks away further and I'm like, I'm such an innovator. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Amazing.
Thank you so much, Molly. You can follow along with Molly's lovable food and farm life at mynameisyeh.com,
Y-E-H,
or on Twitter or Instagram at Molly Yeh.
Yay.
Thanks, Molly.
Thank you guys so much. Home on the range where the deer
some Mazel Tovs of the week. Liel, Stephanie, who wants to go first this week? And you know what? Molly Yeh is still sitting here. Do you have a Mazel Tov, Molly?
Oh, yeah, you guys go first.
We'll go first and then we'll come back to you. Special guest treat. You came from so far. Liel.
So my Mazel Tov would be to German historian Volker Ulrich.
Ah, Volker.
Volker Ulrich, who wrote the unbelievably great new biography of Hitler. Called
Hitler.
Ascent.
Wait, is it like Hitler exclamation mark?
Hitler Ascent. No, I've read the joke.
Hitler colon Ascent?
It's very promising. I don't know how it's going to end. But it seems like the art thing is really working out for him.
Good picture.
He's
good
selling a lot of stuff in Vienna. He's really popular with the kids.
I'm really happy you have such like a good work-life balance that this is what you did over the weekend.
That's what I do over the weekend.
Okay, I gotta
gather around, kids. I want to read you from this book.
Please, Lily, Kinder.
Hop up on Papa's lap.
Kinder. My Mazel Tov is to listener Jeffrey Grossman, who wrote in to say that he worked on Middle Neck Road in Great Neck and asked if I went to North or South. I obviously went to Great Neck North.
Of course.
What is he, a peasant?
And then he gave me an update on Teen Tour companies because he worked at American Trails West, which has since merged with Rhine, which is the Teen Tour I went on. And I've learned more from him than I ever wanted to know about Teen Tours. So thanks, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Grossman. Molly Ye, do you have a special Mazel Tov?
Okay, this is very mushy, but my Mazel Tov is for you guys because I love you guys so much.
Aww, you don't need to give us a Mazel Tov.
You brought us All right,
in case this needs to be said, which I think it doesn't, but you're like our absolute favorite guest of all time.
It's funny that your name is Ye because you are like very exuberant and full of sunshine.
Eating this.
My Mazel Tov.
Sprinkles.
I turned my Mazel Tov over to a listener this week. Lauren Scholder writes, quote, I know you asked longtime listeners to shout out to those they introduced to Unorthodox. I actually want to send a Mazel Tov to the woman who introduced me to the podcast, Alicia Zimmerman, who just gave birth to a beautiful baby boy, Eli Nathaniel. I know she'll be listening to all your upcoming podcasts as she navigates the early days of nonstop breastfeeding and baby care. I'm so thankful for her friendship and also letting me know about this wonderful podcast, which has been so helpful in dealing with this alternate universe in which we now reside. Best, Lauren Scholder. We echo your Mazel Tov to Alicia Zimmerman. We offer her and whoever her partner slash sperm donor slash husband slash lesbian wife is who joins her in welcoming Eli Nathaniel. And we also offer free parenting advice. If she needs any, she should just write to us and we will it won't necessarily be good, but we'll give
advice,
it to her.
Advice number one, get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Our show is edited by Noah, son of Warren Levinson, and produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Telushkin. Rabbinic supervision by the Rabbanim of Grand Forks, North Dakota.
The Vada Rabbonim.
Also kosher slaughtering from them, too.
Also from them, too. They do everything. They also run the mikvah. They do everything there. They do the shotnez testing. Find Tablet Magazine.
The beet farming.
The beet farming. Which are kosher, beets.
Oh my God, Molly, you should be like the Chabad emissary.
Yes.
Perfect.
Fine Tablet.
You already make amazing challah.
I completely lost control. On Twitter, we're at Tablet Mag. Our music is by Golem. We record in Argo Studios where room temperature is 73 degrees. And we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.